So I'm really happy to be with you. I've been sad to hear that my kind of abrupt change in plans caused some upset. And I really apologize that I didn't send out a letter to everyone explaining what I'm up to. It would have been better. Part of the reason that I've made a change in my plans regarding the Sangha was for the very same reason I didn't have the wherewithal to write a letter to everybody. As much as I love retreats, they have become a bit too much for me, and I just get too tired afterwards. And so in case you have questions about my current relationship with you all, I'm very, very dedicated to staying connected and dedicated towards continuing to share some Dharma talks as much as you want in this fashion. And then in the summer, I hope to be here enough to be in the circle with you. And the one thing I won't be doing, as far as anyone can plan anything, is to participate in retreats the way I have been before. And I'm sad about that. But things change. And my abilities are changing. So in case there's a concern in that way, as long as you all are interested in having me participate in this way, I'm very interested in doing it. It's an interesting thing to think about what should be talked about on a Tuesday night when a talk is given. There's a number of things that always lend themselves to a Dharma talk. I'm curious, before I launch into what I thought would be an appropriate topic for tonight, to see if there's anything really up for the Sangha that should be addressed, at least before I launch into what I've planned. Now, I think that I can't hear anything you're saying, but if anybody has anything that I'm not aware of that should be addressed as an issue that's really troubling the Sangha, that we could talk about from a Dharma perspective, I'm happy to detour at this point. And I take it that there probably isn't.
Well, so I've just unmuted. Does anybody want to say anything? No, we're good.
Okay. A kind of preamble for those of you who have heard me talk many times before is that the way I've learned to share the Dharma, the way I choose to share the Dharma, involves a lot of repetition. So those of you who have been listening to me for a long time have the opportunity to work with the very conditioned self that says, I've heard that before. Let's hear something new. And people who are newer certainly benefit from the repetition because they haven't heard some of these things before. But the challenge for those of us who have heard Dharma talks for years is this idea that we've heard this before. And that in itself is a Dharma lesson, because it can't be stressed enough that everything is the first time. Everything has changed in every instant that's gone by. And in a funny way that seems paradoxical, everything is the last time. The lesson here is to maintain a degree of freshness in our approach to the Dharma. Freshness, openness, curiosity, and constantly seeing if we can take the teachings more deeper, take them deeper. That's our challenge as Dharma students. Because indeed, the Buddha actually said that all he teaches is the four thoughts. Everything he shared with his students for the 30 some odd years that he taught was an elaboration on the four thoughts. That everyone suffers, that there's a cause of that suffering, and that's our firm belief in the existence of an individual self that is stable and separate from everything else, the self-other split. So that's the second thought, that there is this cause of suffering. And he spent years teaching us why this caused suffering. And the third thought was his the third noble truth is that he guarantees that there's an end to suffering that's available to everyone. In this instant, actually. Because everything, including the truth, is moment by moment by moment. And that there's a path to coming to this freedom. And this path is his life's work in elucidating it. And then all of us who are called to share the Dharma in different ways, and that includes all of you, are actually reiterating in your own words and in your own experience and in your own activities, living your life, living the Dharma. Each of you is also sharing the Dharma. And it's not only a heavy responsibility, but an opportunity, because it's constant practice. As we practice the Dharma and as we bring it into our lives, we're actually sharing it with others in a completely nonverbal way, perhaps. So tonight I wanted to talk about the middle way. You've heard often that the Buddha taught the middle way, and you've heard probably various teachings on the middle way. There's some stories about the middle way. I like stories. One story that you've probably heard said in many different ways was the Buddha's meeting with a young student who was a veena player, a stringed instrument. And this student was, like many of us, trying to really get it right, trying to be a really good student, trying to practice diligently and get it right. And then at times he would throw up his hands and fall away from the practice altogether. So the Buddha invited him over to the Buddha's place for a talk and asked him to bring his veena. The Buddha said, "I hear you're a veena player, and please bring it." So the young man showed up with the veena and sat down, and the Buddha said, "I hear you've been having some difficulties with your practice. The young person agreed and described these difficulties. And the Buddha said, "That's really interesting. Can I play your veena?" And the kid was okay and passed it over. And the Buddha grabbed this instrument and started tightening the strings and got them tighter and tighter and tighter. And until finally, this student couldn't stand it anymore and said, "No, no, no, you can't tighten them that tightly, they'll break." And the Buddha said, "Oh, sorry." And then he started backing off until they were totally floppy, blowing in the wind. And the student said, "No, no, that's too loose." And the Buddha said, "In this way is your practice. Too tight or too loose. And what you need to do is find the middle ground." Another story about the Buddha coming to this was one that most of us have heard about his years of strict asceticism, to where his body was just wasting away. And finally, coming into a village one day, and a young woman who had just finished milking a cow offered him a bowl of fresh milk. And breaking all of his vows and all of his years of asceticism, he accepted the milk. And for that was rejected by his fellow ascetics. But at this point, he was enacting the middle way. He had been too tight, he was loosening. Too tight or too loose? So in a way, that reflects one model of the Dharma, which is an historical model, actually. And we all live with this history. It affects our study and practice. When the Buddha first started teaching, he was teaching to monastics. In those days, monasticism was considered to be superior to the householder life. Monastics could go deeper and become more awakened or whatever they thought their goal was. So Buddha was teaching monastics. All of these people were living together, and there were problems that happen when people are living together. And so rules were made. And over the years, there were more problems and more rules until there were thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of rules. And this was the stage when it seemed like Buddhism was all about ethics. And one could drive oneself crazy trying to get this perfect. A priest once told me that when young priests are in training, the same pattern occurs. They're being taught all sorts of rules. They try to get it perfect. These are actually usually quite young people. And they fall into the extreme of perfection. And the older priests who are training them call this scrupulosity, being too scrupulous. And they train the priests to not be so scrupulous. And scrupulosity, this kind of neurotic obsession with getting it perfect, was a problem in early Buddhism, because thousands of pages of rules, how are you going to get them all right? And on the other hand, Buddhism developed into an arena chiefly known as Tibetan Buddhism today, which focuses on view. And we've been talking a lot about view in the last few years, view being the way you see the world. Our conditioned view is to see the world as self and other. And the view of interdependence and impermanence is taught as being not only vast, as vast as the sky. Well, we'll stick at the vastness right now, because the way that you fall off the cliff on that end of the view is the view of emptiness become so vast and so airy and so spacious that people drift into feeling like nothing matters. They can do anything, nothing matters. And so the middle way in the history of Buddhism is the bodhisattva vow, the vow of bodhicitta, which is the only Sanskrit term I'm continuing to be having trouble with translating into English for our general use. It means awakening mind, basically. And what it means practically is that you're practicing for the benefit of all beings, even if you don't really understand how that could possibly be, how your meditation could be benefiting all beings. But turning our mind to bodhicitta, the principle that our practice is for the benefit of all beings, is the middle way here. It moves us away from the neuroticism of trying to get it perfect. All the rules, all the techniques, all of the mind states, you name it. We come up with a million things that we try to get perfect. Falling off the cliff into this neurotic drive for perfection, what the priests call scrupulosity. And on the other hand, if you can get lost in the view of emptiness, and get too lofty and spacious and out of touch where you feel nothing matters. So the story on that one is that the patron saint of Tibetan Buddhism, actually considered the second Buddha of Tibet by many people, wandered into Tibet after he was born in the Swat Valley, northern Pakistan, a place that looked very much like the Idaho Panhandle. And it was a center of Buddhism in his day. About 100 or so years after the Buddha died, a whole group of Buddhists migrated into this northern Pakistan area that does look like Idaho, and established centers of learning that were very advanced. And for hundreds of years, it was the center of Buddhism. He grew up there, became very awakened, and then went to some of the bigger universities in India and impressed them, and then took it to Tibet, where they were all heathens and bloodthirsty savages. And he brought his teachings there. And he taught, toward the end of his life, a different way of saying the middle way. He said, my view is as vast as the sky, but my actions are as fine as the grains of finely ground barley. So he's saying that you hold both as the middle way. You don't fall off with having this lofty view which takes you out of humanity and morality altogether. And you save yourself by being scrupulous in a good way, by being kind and by not doing harm. And so in these ways, we find the middle way. And we don't tread the middle way. At least most of us don't. Most of us fall off on one side or the other all the time. In general, I've seen that when young people come to the Dharma, they tend to err on the side of the scrupulosity, really wanting to get it right and feeling they can, and get kind of rigid. That can be good. One can progress a lot, but it can get too rigid. I've known people who have become so obsessed with practicing correctly that they kind of become cut off from their humanity. Us older people sometimes fall off on the other side, and we come to the Dharma late, and we listen, and we try to practice, and we start to think negative things about ourselves and our own abilities. And, oh, I'll never get this. And maybe the Buddha can become awakened, but certainly not me. And that's been a big problem as well in Buddhist practitioners of all ages. So it's kind of like another story, learning to ride a bicycle. If you give a bicycle to a young, fit person in her or his 20s, they might become a riding fanatic and their whole life focus on riding, and they become awesome and become obsessed. And if you try to teach a person in their 70s how to ride the bicycle, you'll often see somebody say, giving up, I can't do this. So either too tight or too loose. If you give a bicycle to a six-year-old, they just simply keep at it. Fall down, get back up, fall down, get back up, fall down, get back up. So the six-year-old teaches us the middle way. And that example of the six-year-old and the bicycle really should be our example for our practice. Of course, we're going to get it wrong again and again and again. Of course, we're going to sit to meditate and we're going to be distracted. And we come back and fall off the bike and come back and get distracted and come back. The six-year-old riding the bicycle is the best analogy I can think of for how we can orient our practice. Of course, we're going to fall down. The six-year-old doesn't take that as any big thing, gets back up, gets back on. So our practice can be that way too, in all phases. So we've been learning the model of practice of view, meditation, and action. We practice the view by studying it and then go through our days trying to see things as being interdependent and impermanent and interpenetrating and interrelated and constantly working on that, which is really the artist's view, by the way, the poet's view, the philosopher's view. We get it wrong. We constantly rubber band back to seeing it in our old conditioned way. And we notice that and we practice the view again. And the same in meditation. We're sitting there, usually either too tight or too loose. Again, the Bodhisattva vow can remind us that it doesn't really matter if we think we're getting it right or not. The effort is for somehow, in some way, bringing benefit to all beings, not just human beings, the living earth. We could spend quite a few talks talking about how our practice benefits all beings, but for right now, I'm just going to name it. It's the middle way. It keeps us on track. It keeps us sane between the neuroticism of trying to be perfect practitioners and the nihilism of saying, oh, I can't do this. And then, of course, in action, in our daily activities. We're not here to be saints. We're here to try to behave on a day-to-day, moment-by-moment basis in ways that support our practice and are kind to self and other. And we sometimes, often, during the day, lose track of that goal altogether. And then when we snap back to thinking, oh, I'm going to try to practice as if I'm integrated with the Dharma, it takes us a while to reorient. So that's why we memorize lists, you know. The paramitas are a simple way of remembering how we orient ourselves to activity. Generosity, moral discipline, which just means no harming of self or other, and patience, just those first three of the six paramitas. Easy to remember, easy to come back to. If we can be generous and non-harming and patient, we're actually bringing activity on the Dharma path. And then the fourth one is diligence, stick-to-itiveness, which the six-year-old shows us how to do. The six-year-old practicing the bicycle is our model for diligence on the Dharma path. Well, then get back up. And then the fifth and sixth paramitas, meditation and wisdom, remind us that meditation is another way of practicing. It's not the only way of practicing. It's funny, different schools of Buddhism put different emphasis on meditation to the point that wherever you enter the Dharma, depending on the group you enter it with, you think meditation is Buddhism, or in some, actually the majority of the world's Buddhists don't meditate at all. So where are we standing there? Well, meditation is a valuable practice tool. And so we have three: view, meditation, and action. We practice the view, we practice meditation, we practice action. These three interweave, they feed each other. They are interdependent and interrelated. They grow each other. And throughout, the middle way is to remember that we're doing this for the benefit of all beings, so that we don't get too personally wrapped up in it. Actually, this Bodhisattva vow, the aspiration of bodhicitta, is brilliant. Because there's actually very few better ways of reducing self-clinging than by orienting yourself to others. So again and again, bodhicitta is the middle way. It's a really good idea to start our practice sessions, our meditation, with gratitude and the aspiration of bodhicitta. Gratitude because having the good fortune to be on a path like this and having the peace and freedom and plenty and enough food and shelter and protection and access to the teachings, we forget how hard that is. Traveling in the Himalaya, meeting many people who wanted to study the Dharma, who, because of circumstances of poverty and great distance, could never access a teacher. And there are no books in these regions. We have Dharma books, we have Dharma teachings available on all of our devices. It's good to be grateful, because that also reduces self-clinging and the aspiration of bodhicitta, that somehow, whether I believe it or not, I'm going to dedicate this practice to the benefit of all beings of the living earth. And that reduces self-clinging. So there's an opening there, a softening there. And then we practice to the best of our ability, like a six-year-old on a bicycle. That's it. There's another story. That you've heard before, but is worth remembering. That reminds us that we don't really know what's going to happen. We really can't control what's going to happen. We don't even really know that our ideas of what should happen are right. Woe to you if you think you're right. So there's many ways that we get distracted from the path. And this story, I kind of digressed a little bit. This story is the one where a person is running from a grave threat, a tiger or some bodily threat. And comes to the edge of a cliff and falls off and grabs a branch and is hanging there by this branch. And sees that a mouse is nibbling through the branch, and below is a tiger waiting for you to fall and be dashed on the rocks, and then the tiger will eat you. So you're holding onto a branch which is going to break, and the tiger down there is going to eat you, and you see a strawberry hanging there within reach. And you admire how beautiful the strawberry is, and you pluck it and enjoy the flavor. That's another, not only a statement of the middle way, but it's a statement of dealing with the moment, appreciating what we have in the moment, appreciating what's available to us in the moment. In the moment is all we get. Our ideas of a future are, if we're lucky, approximately close to true. That's the best we can do. And our clinging to the past is already distorted, as our neuroscientists are telling us. But right in front of us, in the face of seeming destruction and horribleness, is this ripe strawberry, which we are challenged to totally appreciate. My sister, with whom I'm staying right now, listened to a talk by Dr. Curry, who's the head of the Episcopal Church in the National Cathedral in Washington. And Dr. Curry quoted a slave woman in the days of slavery, right at the ending days of slavery, who was describing the horrors that she and her family had lived through, absolute horrors. And after she finished describing this to whoever was chronicling this, this woman looked up with a smile on her face and she said, "But hallelujah anyway." I just learned that Annie Lamott wrote a book by that title. I think it's a recent book. Maria Popova, who some of you read in her Sunday column called Brain Pickings, which is a free thing that you can get by email, which is a national treasure, a world treasure, by the way. But Maria Popova claims that this book is a gem. Hallelujah, anyway. So I think that's enough. Why don't we turn back on, turn off your mutedness, and see if there are any questions or comments. And I can't hear a thing.
I was kind of waiting to see if somebody would come up before I unmuted, but we're unmuted now.
Good. I feel more comfortable with that anyway.
Nice. Oh, I'll ask a question. You didn't have to come all the way up. Not really related to your talk, though, but one of the things that we've been trained on is to really kind of back away from our story.
Yes.
And I was at this marvelous art exhibit in Coeur d'Alene, and to me, part of the beauty of this person's art was their story. So I feel like, in a way, is there a way to incorporate the story into the practice without getting lost in the story?
Did the artist accomplish that?
Well, Urs is dead. So I'm not sure. For me as the observer, though, I was able to look at this art and read this man's story. And if I had not had a story, the art would not have been nearly as significant.
Okay.
And so I sometimes feel like maybe we lose a certain richness because we've so trained ourselves to not talk our story. And I think sometimes, to me, the story and the Dharma can go hand in hand without the woe is me type story.
Yeah, that's a beautiful question, Gina. And it's a hot question. And one could give 100 talks or write the books about different ways of approaching this. From a Dharma perspective, from my own small wedge of experiencing the Dharma, I've found that stories within our practice, like when I'm sitting meditating and my story pops in, I am being distracted from what I'm trying to do in meditation. My thoughts and emotions come in, thoughts capture the emotions and turn them into stories. So when I ask a person when I was working, how are you feeling? The person would often say, well, I just had a fight with my husband and my husband left and my son is being a jerk and my daughter is this and my granddaughter is that and my boss hasn't been nice to me. And nowhere are they telling me how to feel. Mm-hmm. They're telling me an elaboration, which is actually a distraction. And I have to remind them, oh, it sounds like you feel bad, or whatever. So bringing people back to actually what's happening in the moment. So stories are wonderful. I told several stories tonight. Stories are teaching tools. Stories help find meaning in life, in our normal life. Stories are the foundation, so much harder. But when we're sitting meditating, a story can be a huge reification of self and other. In that self-other split, there are very few stories of unity. There are stories of self-other. That's not bad. The story is not bad. It's just that the story is ordinary. And when we're practicing view, meditation, or action within a Dharma framework, we're trying to take a little time out of our life to do something that's not ordinary. Because we do the ordinary all the time. We're telling ourselves the story all the time. Creating it, recreating it, recreating it, and recreating it, and elaborating on it. And we tell our friends our story all the time. In Dharma, try to do something that's not ordinary. That's why we go that way. We're not trying to eliminate the story. The story is beautiful. I love reading novels. But for this 20 minutes that you're sitting down, the goal is to try to do something that's not ordinary. When we're in our circle, trying to create a sacred space of something that's different. Why do something to do with your best friend over a cup of coffee? You can do that with your best friend over a cup of coffee. We try to do something different for the brief moment we practice the Dharma. Stories are wonderful, but we're trying to train ourselves into something that's a little different. Great question.
Thank you.
Great answer.
Yeah. I've had some great teachers. That's what this is all about, you know. I'm sharing with you how my teachers have led me and how that has baked in my own practice. And then your activities and interactions with other people are doing, whether you know it or not, the same thing. To the degree you constantly bring the Dharma into your life, you're teaching the Dharma. Greetings.
Hi, Terry.
Great to see you.
Good to see you. I'm happy to hear that you're well.
I'm feeling really good.
And just aging normally.
Indeed.
I have to ask you a technical question. Are you getting echo or feedback while I'm talking?
I am not.
Okay, thank you. I wanted to say to you, you always, it feels to me like you're almost apologizing for your Dharma talks because you are afraid you're repeating yourself. What I found, some of the books that you recommended, now I've read them with the book group, and many times I've read the chapters 3, 4. These are 2-3 page chapters. And what I find is every time I read them, there's a different meaning, which makes sense because I'm that much older than I was before and I've had more experiences.
Yes.
So I just wanted to assure you from my perspective, don't be afraid of repeating yourself. All right. So that's what I wanted to reiterate to you. It's good to see you and good to know that you're well and you're going to stay with us for a while.
As well, as long as I can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, Rick brings up a really important thing, which is that repetition is actually what we learn. And it's also an honoring of the fact that every time is the first time and every time is the last time. As my teacher used to say, the entire universe totally changes 64 times in the blink of an eye. Every time you blink eyelids, between one blink and the next, the universe has changed 64 times. Now, I'm not sure how he came up with that. Teachers that tell him that. But the point is that this is the truth. And the more we can be fresh enough to appreciate that truth, the more we can be fresh enough to know that each time I see you different and I'm different and the context is different, then there's an opportunity for transformation. Rick reminds me too of another way of thinking about how we practice the Dharma. My wife Carol and I have both noticed that when we were studying Norwich recordings, so we took copious notes and have volumes in our bookcases of our notes, and we read them. And every time I reread notes, even from a long time ago, I learned something new. And so this is how I studied the Dharma, was by, I'm a visual learner, not an auditory learner. So by writing, I was able to get it more into my brain than if just listening. But then going from rereading, every few years rereading, it goes in deeper and little ahas, and those affect my practice. Same words that he said in 94, but totally different meaning for me as my practice develops. So that's another thing about practice is repetition. We just keep at it, because if we can come at it to the degree we can come at our practice with freshness, and with immense self-kindness, trying to mimic the six-year-old on the bike, just getting back up, getting on it, then that kind of freshness is the opening for transformation, for magic, really. And there's an intimacy to that freshness, which is related to the fact that whether you approach the Dharma through activity or through view, in both ways, meditation is helping it. And you touch this loving nature, this essential nature of everything, which is so fresh and so intimate and so much like, well, the only word that really fits is love. And you've all touched it many, many, many times in your life in many circumstances. And then it goes by because of our conditioning and things happening around us, but we've all touched it. You all know it. You all know the taste of the truth. And what we're doing here is not trying to discover something new. We're just trying to allow this transformation where we recognize it more and more. It's our own true nature. It's the true nature of everything. It's one reason that we avoid ordinary activity like stories or any other ordinary activity, because we're trying to do something different. We're trying to create space for something different. And in that space, transformation happens. Transformation of the subject-object split, which keeps us separate from tasting the truth. And there's a reason why almost all human beings find it easier to have openings to nature. We're walking in the redwoods or in the forests of the Idaho Panhandle, or canoeing across the lake in the morning. We're less encumbered by the ordinary conditioning that has to do with relating to humans, and we're relating to something bigger. And there's less chance when we're late in the dawn, we're watching sunrise at night, to be self-critical. We're just watching the moon come up. We're not doing something wrong or doing something right. We're just beholding something majestic. We want our meditation to be like that too, if we can. Self-criticism is self-clinging. We're conditioned. Or to pride, whatever we're conditioned to, but they're all self-clinging. So we're trying to loosen our grip on that by seeing it in action. And when we're out in the moonlight on a still lake, there's less of that kind of thing going on. I don't have a clock with me. Oh, just a few minutes left. Any other questions or comments? So for those of you who, if you're in the room who have had the chance to see the hand on view, meditation, action, talk to Gina. Another handout I would recommend all people who are relatively new would be a handout on Tonglen. It's a summary that Pema Chödrön did. Tonglen is a marvelous tool for less self-clinging, more working for the benefit of all. And then a handout on the four thoughts, those three. The four thoughts being the Four Thoughts That Turn the Mind to the Dharma that I would strongly recommend you try anyway, if you haven't yet, reciting these simple reminders, contemplations or reflections when you wake up in the morning, when you start practice at different times. I'm aware of the preciousness of this very life, my circumstances, my ability to study the Dharma. I'm aware of the inevitability of death and change. I'm aware that all my activities count. Everything I do can cause benefit or harm for myself or others. And the fourth one, I'm aware that everyone suffers. This opens our heart. And if you don't have handouts on those, Gina can help you. Thank God for Gina. She has helped me so much with getting these handouts together year after year after year after year. So thank you. And above all, one of the most powerful acts of deconditioning is to be very kind to yourself. Because the kinder you are to yourself, despite all conditioning to the opposite, the more this benefit for all beings can leak out. And that means even being kind to yourself when you can't be kind to yourself. You know what I mean? Even when you fall down. Okay. Love you guys. Thanks so much.
Terry.
Thank you, Terry.
Yeah, thank you, Terry. Bye.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you. Oh, wonderful. I didn't even know you were there.
I have to say this Zoom thing is really neat from this perspective. I'm always in the chairs that you're in. And it's not unintimate. Mm-hmm. So it's been nice being with you.
Indeed. And Mary Jo, are you still there?
We are. Yeah, we are. Thank you.
Wonderful to see you again.
With you and everyone.
Thank you also. Yeah.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everybody. Bye.
Thanks, Gina. Thanks, yeah, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
You're welcome. So great to have you along.
Yes. Great to be here.
Nice. That worked well.
Yeah.
Okay. Much love.
Much love. Good night.
Night.
Bye. Good night.
How cool is this?